Hey everyone, welcome to Historians of the Movies podcast, the home of all things film and history of film and elsewhere. I'm your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and we've got an awesome conversation for you today. We're talking about maybe the most unlikely history film ever made, Seth MacFarlane's A Million Ways to Die in the West. And today I've got for you one of my absolute favorite scholars in the entire world, Sarah Dant. She is a professor of history at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. She is an environmental historian of the West. So today we get into the history of the West, what's at stake in understanding the West, the problems in environmental history, and really what's at stake in getting all of this right. We talk about the West in film, but we also talk about some of my favorite words in charismatic megafauna. We talk about wolf reintroduction in the West. We talk about grizzly bears, and we talk about mountain lions in more forms and more ways than just one. So I hope you're ready. Get ready to draw. Sit back and relax, because A Million Ways to Die in the West is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Hi, Sarah Dant. How are you?
I am great, Jason. Thank you so much for having me today.
I feel like we are doing this like transmontane podcast today. We're like broadcasting over the Rockies and many other mountainous regions.
Where you could die, right? It would be yet another of the million ways to die in the West.
Oh my God, there's so many ways to die in the West. There should be a sequel called A Million Ways to Die in Australia, because I feel like that might be like the only more dangerous place. I always used to argue that like Florida is actually America's Australia, because we've got all the same stuff. But also watching this, I'm like, maybe America is America's Australia. I don't know.
Boy, you're getting deep. You're getting deep quick.
Oh, yeah. Well, when we start talking about what is the West, which is the question I want to ask you here in a minute.
Okay.
It's like I'm gonna sell my book as Florida is the West, but like whatever, that's fine. I'm so excited to have you here.
Well, thank you.
This is the first comedy I think we've done on the podcast. Now that I think about
it. Well, you had asked, you know, we should do a movie on the West. What would you like to do? And of course, one can get all serious and like, oh man, I should be performative, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I should do like The Searchers. And then I thought, no, actually, what would be really, really fun is A Million Ways to Die in the West, because for one thing, that movie cracks me up. And for another thing, you can totally tell that Seth knows his history.
He does.
So I'm down for it. So let's be funny and serious at the same time.
No, he knows his history and he knows his film history, right? There's so many homages in this film. I rewatched this movie last night and then also today. I've been watching so many movies. I had to watch Red Dawn 7 times in 5 days.
Ooh, I'm so sorry.
That pot's coming up. Like I can quote it at this point in time. This movie's a more fun watch, you know, because you get Liam Neeson hamming things up. Thank you for giving me an excuse to watch Charlize Theron. Like that was.
And this is the best I've ever seen Charlize, you know, and I got to say, you know, I like her. I like watching her too, but this is the funniest, and she's funny.
Can we talk a little bit about Charlize Theron before we get going here real fast?
Because
I think she is phenomenal. And I think she almost has a Brad Pitt problem for her career, something like that. I think that, you know, like Pitt is such a handsome guy that he looks like this leading man, and he is, but he's really a character actor in a leading man's body. He's that good of an actor. And I think she is too. You know, she's overwhelmingly beautiful. And at the same time, she's got this amazing ability to do drama, to do action, you know. And then also, she's good in this. Like, she's done a few comedies now, and she's very solid.
Yeah, she is. And, you know, so she's beautiful. But then she's also, I mean, you absolutely know that Charlize Theron could kick your ass and take your name, and there's no doubt about it. So whether she's being Mad Max or playing in this film, you know, she has that certain command of the scene and herself that is, it's very admirable. And I think it makes her all the more striking.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. And McFarlane's just fun. Like, all he's just playing off of everybody. This is a different role for Liam Neeson, who I grew up I will love Liam Neeson till I die. I remember watching him in like 1992. There's this movie that came out called Next of Kin. Do you know this movie? It's with him and Patrick Swayze, and essentially they're guys from Kentucky, and Patrick, who end up going into a blood feud with the mob in Chicago, and Liam Neeson's like leading these good old boy hillbillies from the mountains of Kentucky to go up and fight. So my people were just all about, you know, Liam Neeson from a very early age.
Well, and you know, the best thing for Liam Neeson in this movie is that none of his family gets taken.
Oh, I just see what you did there. Well, how many times has he been a bad guy in a film?
Well, he's such a good bad guy. And I mean, but he also makes the worst choices sometimes. Like, have you seen the movie The Gray?
Oh, yeah. With the wolves?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I want to talk to you about that.
With the attacking wolves. I mean, can we please just, oh, my God. He sets back wolf ecology, you know, 100 years with that.
Okay, I actually want to talk to you about wolf ecology. I'm serious about this. This was actually, I had two things I want to talk to you about, things that are very relevant to Colorado right now. One of which is wolves are being reintroduced into Colorado, I think today. And then there's this massive announcement by the Biden administration today. Today is December 8th for anybody counting at home. And they just announced there's going to be a whole lot of high-speed rail that's going to be built throughout the United States, including a little bit linking Colorado, I think Colorado Springs or no, Fort Collins, all the way down here to Pueblo. And, you know, so you've got these two classically Western things in a lot of ways, wolves and railroads. There are other things, obviously, death, but very much in the news today. And I definitely want to circle back and talk to you about wolves. I actually had a note to myself to like talk to you about Liam Neeson and The Gray and wolf, you know, extirpation in American history, and I guess elsewhere too, because we're not the only people killing off wolves. Like it's our job.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the big bad wolf, and you got to save Little Red Riding Hood, right?
Doesn't that come though? Isn't there we get into like wolf extirpation? Let's just jump into it now. When we talk about the history of wolf extirpation in the United States, doesn't a lot of this come from like European stories of wolves as the big villain, as the threat? Isn't that kind of where ranchers who were moving over and bringing maybe their livestock traditions from old Europe, bringing that into your, do they not just see wolves as the necessary bad? Is there like a cultural thing going on? Why do we kill wolves in the United States? Because wolves are awesome.
Yeah, they are. So I will say that. Wolves are one of those animals that Europeans know about from Europe, and they've got Aesop's fables and every other kind of childhood scare story about the big bad wolf. So it's interesting that when Europeans come to America, they bring those prejudices. Imagine that. They bring those prejudices, including the ones about wolves, with them. And so it's a real targeted campaign when we decide that we're going to, as a nation, prioritize ranching and the expansion of the cattle frontier into the West. We need to get rid of the thing that kills cows. Well, I mean, you know, that's such a simplified understanding of what's happening. And part of the reason that wolves do predate on cows is because we've taken out everything else. We've taken out buffalo. We've taken out elk. We've taken out pronghorns. We've taken out all of the normal things that wolf packs need for their survival. And we've replaced it with this slow, stupid cow. I mean, if you're a wolf, how do you not look at that and say, that's what I'm going for. And, you know, in his book, Coyote America, Dan Flores talks about how, in fact, you know, because Europeans don't have any experiences with coyotes, they don't have those same prejudices initially. And it really takes somebody like Mark Twain giving people the language to hate coyotes. And then we just effectively lump them together. And once we've effectively extirpated wolves, well, then we just move right on to coyotes.
Yeah, that's a fun thing about Dan's book, right? Is that he just kind of shows that, yeah, good luck extirpating coyotes. You cannot kill them. They are a fat. Oh my God. I love coyotes so freaking much. They are one of my favorite animals in all of North America. Mm-hmm. I've read Dan's book. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm just the biggest fanboy when it comes to Dan's work. You talk about pronghorns.
I'm more of a fan. I'm more of a fan than you are.
Do you want to say it?
No, I'm more of a fan than you are because, you know, I happen to be married to the guy.
Well, there's that. I mean, so my favorite thing about American Serengeti, which is one of his other books there, is I love telling the story of pronghorns because that chapter is laid out so fucking well where he's laying out like how here's the last surviving animal of its age and here's why and so forth. And I used to teach this to high schoolers when I was writing my dissertation. And I would always tell them, I'm like, look, if you lived in this time period, you wouldn't make it to your mailbox, you know, because there were just everything out there of step lions. What the fuck is that?
Big bad.
Oh my gosh, so much fun. But we probably would have killed them too as Americans. Like, let's shoot them, whatever. That's fine. Now people listening are going to be all sad. But this is not a podcast about Dan. I don't care about Dan Flores today. I care about Sarah. I'll tell you what, let's do this. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you. I know you, but who are you and what are you doing here? How's that?
So I am Sarah Dant. I am the professor and chair of history at Weber State University. Part of my mission in life is to get everyone to pronounce Weber correctly. The grill has just made it so difficult to be from my university for a very long time. So Weber all together now, Weber State. Great, great, great. And I teach American West. I teach environmental history. And one of the things I realized in teaching the West and environmental history is no one had written an environmental history of the West. I needed that for my classes. I wanted to be able to talk about that with students. And so that was my task. I decided, all right, well, if it doesn't exist, then I guess that is a good enough sign that I need to write it. So I did. And it's a big history of the West. So it starts when the first people come to North America, which, as you know, the science, the newest science that I was able to incorporate in this book, we're pushing that date back 20,000, 30,000 years ago. Some really terrific genomic studies that are being done. And also just talk about one of the things I wanted to be sure I did in that opening chapter was really integrate what the science is saying and what Native people say about where they're from and what their origin stories are. And to talk about, in fact, there's tremendous overlap. But it's a kind of a wild romp through American history, but from this new perspective, not new perspective, but from the different perspective of looking at the interaction of people and nature over time, rather than talking about presidents and wars. I think that a lot of times we forget that the stage on which history happens has as much effect on the events of the past than the people themselves do. So it starts way back in the day and comes up to, through 2022.
I know. Okay. So I read your book. In fact, when I took this job out in the Forest Service that definitely does not sponsor my podcast. But when I took this job, I reached out to you. I was like, hey, what should I be reading? And you're like, I've got a book for you to read. Right. It's like, okay, yes, I'll read your book. And I love it. Right. I love it so much. And I feel like you do this really, really difficult thing, which is condense all of these years into this very approachable. I mean, you've got a book here that's, I don't know how many, what's our page? It's about what, 300-ish or so. Mm-hmm. That's really hard to do because I think as scholars, we get wrapped up in the minutia and the super details. And I think it's easy to get lost in that. And this really keeps the big picture stuff at play here that you can really relate to, which I hope we're going to get into today. Something tells me that we're going to get into things like, you know, land ownership and the spread of settlers into the West and all that. And then when you chose this movie, like I thought, okay, let's talk about the West. And I'm thinking Jeremiah Johnson, I'm thinking something like that. And you hit me with Seth MacFarlane, A Million Ways to Die in the West. I was like, we had never spoken in person before. I was like, oh, this tells me a lot more about Sarah than I thought that I knew.
Yeah.
So I have one other big question for you before we move on. Coke or Pepsi? Where do you stand in that war?
This is a hill I will die on, Jason. And I'm afraid that you and I may be on opposite sides of the fence here, but I'm a Coca-Cola girl. I have always been a Coca-Cola girl, and I will be a Coca-Cola girl.
We are best friends. No, I am.
All the more so because of my buddies here in the background.
Okay, so those of you who can't see, Sarah has a stand-up of Han Solo and Chewbacca back behind her. I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt, and there is a TIE fighter over my left shoulder right over there, just above my a little Theodore Roosevelt teddy bear. So we're off to a good start over here. So, oh no, good. Yeah. I was afraid you were going to say Pepsi.
Oh God, no, that's a hill I'll die on. I will. When you go to a restaurant and they say, what would you like? And I'll say, I want a Coke. And they'll say, oh, well, we have Pepsi. And I'll say, okay, water's good. Cause yeah. I'm not drinking that shit.
No, I won't drink it either. If I'm in the South, I can trust that they'll have sweet tea and I can deal with that. Out here in Colorado, they'll just point to sugar. I can't even get sugar packets out here, like crystal sugar. They point to like this weird stuff. And listen, I've been writing a lot recently about sugar being evil in Florida, like the battle against the Everglades, and because the sugar companies down in Florida just fucking awful. One of the things I should tell my students is like, look at every situation in American history and tell me when a plantation has been good. It hasn't.
Oh, yeah, right.
Obviously we think about the antebellum South, think about Hawaii, think about in Florida Cuba. Now, it's just Cuba. Exactly. Right. I'm lining up a Scarface podcast. That's going to be so much fun that's going to be nuts, but that's another story. You talked about this W word just a few months ago, before we jump in this movie, you talked about the West, and this whole idea is like, there's a million ways to die in the West. And I feel like this term, the West, is this mischievous, almost like coyote-ish kind of thing. Sarah, what's the West in your mind? When we talk about the West, what are you talking about? Is it a place? Is it a time? What is it? Where is it?
Well, so I would definitely say there are a million ways to define the West, too. Oh. I just was dying to get that one in there. And that's one of the ways I've always started my classes on the West is before I hand out a syllabus or anything like that, I'll say to students, go up on the board and back in the day when we had chalk, but now it's whiteboard. But, so where is the West? And most of them will do, it's the Mississippi, it's the Rocky Mountains, it's, and then you get like Farragher, who thinks Pennsylvania is the West, or like Jason Herbert, who thinks Florida is the West.
Hell yeah.
And that it gets really... Right, exactly. So I actually sent you an image mm-hmm. that I feel like in some ways really does make a definitive case for the West. But in general, I, as an environmental historian, I want to look at where can we see real change on the land itself and in the land itself. And to me, that's defined by the 100th meridian. Roughly the 100th meridian, which is the line of latitude that approximately separates the drier west from the wetter east. And right around the 100th meridian is where you get the switch to about 20 inches of average annual rainfall. And that's the magic number. If you have 20 inches or more, typically you can, and it's a weird term, you can dry farm, which means you don't need to irrigate. Anything less than 20 inches and you need to irrigate. So to me, that's one of the great defining characteristics of the West is its aridity. That's something Wallace Stegner talked about that really gave the West its character. And obviously that not every place in the West, all along the Pacific coast, for example, doesn't fall into that. But the other, to me, really defining character piece for the West is public lands. And that image that I sent you, and I don't know if you have a way to put it up or not, but it's a map of the public lands of the United States. And it's a map that shows each of the states in outline. And then within the state, it has another representative size for the public lands. And what you can see is that the 11 Western public states have, on average, more than half of all of their land base is public lands. And that absolutely ends in this dramatic fashion with all of the states that are east of those 11 Western states. So it doesn't include Texas, for example, and that's always a big question. Is Texas the West, and or is Texas the South?
No.
And
well, we're not taking them.
Yeah, well, I'm giving them to you.
No, we are not.
And the public lands are one of the major ways that you can see that, because Texas has almost no public lands. And that was a legacy of when they got, when they were independent and then they got brought back into the United States. One of the ways they resolved their debt issues was by selling off what would have been the public domain. So to me, that's one of the really defining characteristics. And as someone who's working for the Forest Service, you're very well aware that curating those public lands, managing those public lands in the West for the good of all the people, not just the people who live next to them, can be really, really challenging. And I've spent a good deal of time, especially in the last maybe 5 or 6 years, talking to people about the public lands because there's so much misperception about them. You know, when we set aside the bear's ears, for example, here in Utah, oh my goodness, or Grand Staircase Escalante, or any of those national monuments, people really blew up. Like with bear's ears, for example, I think it's like 1.3 million acres was the Obama designation. And the screaming was just, oh my goodness, the government just seized 1.3 million acres. And it's like, you know, that's not how that works. It's just a redesignation of extant public lands. All of the lands that comprise Bears Ears were already in Forest Service and BLM, Bureau of Land Management, hands. It just created a unified land management plan for those millions of acres. That's all it is. Wilderness is the same way. People think, oh, they just steal these lands. And it's like, no, wilderness lands can't be designated on anything that isn't already in the public domain.
Yeah, there's an incredible, this almost this idea that we're that these places we're taking are keeping people from owning. And it's like, you're a public landowner. You know, Steven Rinella is always talking about this, where people are like, you're a public landowner. He's got these shirts. It's like, where he talks specifically about the beauty of these places. These are protected, because otherwise you end up in a place like Texas, which is neither the South nor the West. Really closer to hell now that I think about it. Thank God there's an Indiana, which is worse than Texas, but you know, maybe only barely. I don't know. So, I guess one of the questions I want to ask you though is why is the West so important for us to understand, specifically in environmental history of the West? You know, you're talking about this. I was kind of flummoxed when we started thinking about the fact that there really wasn't specific environmental histories to the West, and you would have just assumed that there. Somebody would have done this already, but no. So what's the need for what's it, to borrow a cow pun I learned once from Dan Richter, what's at stake in learning the environmental history of the West?
Well, I think this is a pretty meaty issue, really. I mean, sorry, you just led with your chin on that one. But one of the things that I argue in my book, Losing Eden, is that we have to understand the environmental history of the West, because in many ways it's like the rest of the nation accelerated because of the aridity of the West and because of the presence of significant public lands. We can see things like climate change and environmental destruction. They happen at a rate in the West because of our inability to regenerate because we don't get a lot of rain. Those things happen at a rate that is much more visible in a really short period of time. And the question, and you obviously know this if you read the book, the question I like to ask a lot in that book, when I give talks in class, is at what cost? Rather than trying to point fingers and say, oh, you guys screwed up or you guys screwed up, that to me is assigning blame doesn't really advance anything. But asking at what cost, what are we learning from this understanding of the past that we're getting? And then how do we apply what we've learned, that at what cost, to moving forward? So something like the bison story, for example, and I had the great fortune to be on the recent Ken Burns American Buffalo documentary, two-part documentary. And one of the things we really, the historians for that, really pushed hard for was, please make it clear that there are choices that have consequences. And when we make these choices, particularly choices about the market, and that we're going to allow the market to set value on nature, on animals, on lands, on plants, when we let the market establish value, then we're almost dooming whatever that is to destruction. And, you know, William Hornaday had a terrific line about that, that it's an inexorable truth that any species that comes, I'm not getting the quote quite right, but any species that comes into the orbit of the market is basically doomed to extinction or flirting with extinction, because that's the cost of commodifying nature and the animals in nature. And we do that over and over again in the West. So the buffalo is the most obvious example, but it happens to grizzlies and wolves, as we talked about, and pronghorns and elk. All of those species come into the orbit of the market, and all of them in a really short period of time flirt with extinction.
You know, I think one of the fascinating things, we're talking a little bit about the ideas like what is the West and what is it, maybe in part defined, like you're saying, by public land ownership. And I can't help but think, and this is one of my great frustrations, is that actually a couple guys from Utah, of all places, I'm thinking, is it Jason Chavitz? I forget how to pronounce his, was trying to sell off so much of our public lands. And Mike Lee as well is one of these guys. You know, I'm just going to call these sons of bitches out because I can't stand it, because they're trying to give away my stuff. You know, yeah. They're trying to sell the things that belong to the people. And I feel like this is a real disconnect. And I've talked to some other scholars about this. And I feel like in a lot of ways, this is where liberals have really failed to drive home this point to people who hunt and fish. You know, your classic, you know, guys like my father or someone like that, who tended to vote Republican and so forth. It's like, wait a second, because of the gun issue or whatever. And it's like, look, the places where you hunt, the places where you fish, the places where you commune with your maker or the outdoors, these are in jeopardy because of these policies, are they not?
Well, indeed. And, you know, that's one of the great losses, I think, for the environmental movement, the conservation movement, whatever you want to call it. When you look at turn of the 20th century, Theodore Roosevelt, Boone and Crockett Club kind of people, it was sportsmen, sports hunters, mm-hmm. and fishers who were also advocates for the public lands and who saw the federal government as the best steward of these natural resources. Now, to be sure, I mean, what motivates TR and people like him is that they want to continue to hook and shoot the stuff that they've always hooked and shot. But it did make them really active in the efforts to protect and preserve these regions and wildlife refuges, places like that. You have women in the turn of the 20th century who initially are participating in the, you know, having birds on their hats. And the devastation of the plume trade is astonishing. I was just watching the other night an episode of The Gilded Age on HBO. And bless their hearts, I mean, the costumers are incredible, but they got a whole bunch of these feathered hats on there. And I was thinking, oh, that's historically accurate and horrifying at the same time. But when some of those women began to realize that the at what cost calculus of what they were doing, they're the ones who began to form the state and local Audubon groups that ultimately went about protecting, passing the Lacey Act, things like that. So there are real opportunities to create unity. But I think, you know, and you just mentioned it in passing, but there's some good history to suggest that one of the major cleaving points is the gun rights issue. And when enviros, particularly in the 60s and 70s, when you have a lot of bipartisanism, Republicans, Democrats are all green. By the time we get to the 1980s, enviros really didn't see the significance and importance of keeping sport hunters and fishers in the environmental movement. And the gun issue in particular, gun rights, sort of got shaved off and creates these two oppositional groups. And in many ways, you can almost see at the same time the Sagebrush Rebellion issues that are tapping into that. And the same sorts of problems that you were just railing about a minute ago, the ahistorical reality of the Sagebrush Rebellion never ceases to frustrate me. Here are these people arguing that the states need to take back their lands. And it's like, look, unless you were one of the original 13, ain't none of it ever been your land. Mm-hmm. It was federal land that was, you know, public domain. It was, states were created out of that. You've not ever had this land. And it's not your land. It's our land. It is the land of all of us.
And I definitely want to underscore the point here is that, you know, the most diehard conservationists that I know are hunters and fishermen. These mm-hmm. are the,
you people know, like and, Stephen Rinella.
Oh, Stephen Rinella is just the leader. And so I literally have a meat eater mm-hmm. podcast sticker on the back of my truck. I cited him in my dissertation because I wanted him in my diss. But, you know, there's an amazing group down in Florida called Captains for Clean Water who are fighting the fight for clean water down in the Everglades against those sugar companies and things like that, you know? We're talking a little bit about how we understand the West and so forth. And I want to kind of start to circle back to maybe this film for a moment. We'll talk about the movie for like 3 minutes or so. But okay, like good. A Million Ways to Die in the West clearly references a whole lot of other tropes that we see in Westerns and things like that. One of the things I think that you and I certainly recognize is the way in which pop culture has affected our understandings of the past. And so much of what I think a lot of people understand of the West is kind of filtered through pop culture. You mentioned The Searchers, which was a film that I watched with my grandfather on the couch growing up, along with a slew of other films. Can we talk a little bit about maybe what we've seen traditionally in the history of the West through film? Like what are these tropes and things like? What has film taught us about the West that maybe isn't always right?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I like about this movie is, and also, you know, while we're at it, Blazing Saddles, is because it's this huge send-up of the stereotypes and the iconography that got captured, you know, by Frederick Jackson Turner, for heaven's sakes, where what the West is it's, you know, cowboys, it's Indians, it's horses, it's cows. It's and the cowboys, by the way, are all white and they're good. And women wear tight-waisted dresses that are clean all the time and have their hair done nicely and take care of the children. I mean, there's just such a stereotype that I would say, you know, Quentin Tarantino even went there in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he's got Leonardo DiCaprio's character being in kind of a classic Western set. And, you know, you have to have a bar scene and you have to have a little girl in trouble and you have to have the bad, you know, landowners. There are such powerful stereotypes and they get played over and over. It's one of the reasons I really appreciated The Unforgiven when it came out was that it went after a lot of the romantic Shane kind of tropes on the West and said, wait a minute, you know, there's a lot of grittiness and ugliness. So, I mean, you can be Clint Eastwood and you can go after Westerns, even the original Westerns that you made, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, those spaghetti Westerns that he made initially in many ways get sent up by The Unforgiven. But you could also then go after Westerns and the stereotypes in them with comedy. And that's one of the things that I think Seth does really well. And, you know, he makes the Western so accessible because there are all these little Easter eggs of popular contemporary things in the movie. For example, you know, the scene where he and Charlize are eating pot cookies. I mean, that's just funny. And that's completely irrelevant and it's ahistorical, but, you know, God, way to go, man. That's really good. And it allows them to get at some of the stereotypes and reveal them to be completely absurdist and ridiculous. So I liked this film for that reason. It was a really good shorthand way to get at a lot of stupidity that has been repeated over and over and over again in a lot of those so-called classic Westerns.
You know, one of the things I kept thinking about earlier this week was Kevin McCarthy, former Speaker of the House, recently came out and said something to the effect of the United States has never asked for land after a war.
Oh, yeah.
Ever. And I kept thinking, it's like, is he on pot brownies? What's going, you know, he can't be serious here, right? Because every amount of West is indigenous land.
Ever take a basic American history class? Good God. You know, and Charlize Theron gets at that, right? So when they're at the fair and somebody or another dies in the photo booth or whatever, and she's like, oh my goodness. And he says, yeah, that happens every year. People died last year. You know, this person got shot and this person got stabbed and the Indians attack. And she says, why are the Indians so mad? We basically are splitting this land 50-50 with them. And I thought, oh, God, you just, you know, to use a classic American studies term, you just unpacked a lot of shit right there, Charlize. Well done. But, you know, that was just this nice, tight little piece that hit at so much of the troubled history of the West.
This film obviously has Native folks in here in a very humorous role. And you've really got, man, I am dying to meet, I hope I can meet him one day, Wes Studi, who giving Wes Studi all day long and pretty much anything I've ever seen, I would kill to meet Wes Studi. Can we talk a little bit about because he's taken these traditional roles that he's done. Of course, we just did Last of the Mohicans a few weeks ago here on the pod. At some point in time, I'm going to have to talk about dances at some point in time. But can we talk a little bit about Wes Studi in this film and
why absolutely he's
an amazing?
Well, and so let me preface, the other reason is a little personal that I wanted to do A Million Ways to Die in the West. And that is because from several vantage points in the shots in the movie, you can see our house, or at least basically where our house is in Santa Fe. Dan and I live right out on by the Cerritos Hills, which when they do the shot of the fair and they actually pull up, the camera pulls up and does an overview shot, the mountains that are in the background are the Cerritos Hills, which is like a mile from our house. So for me, that's really a fun aspect of that movie is in some of the chase scenes when they're on horses or whatever, because I know the landscape really well. I mean, they have mishmashed things like they'll be out in front of the Cerritos Hills and then they're riding and suddenly they're going past Ship Rock and then, which is like, you know, several hundred miles away. And then, here they are out in the Jemez Pueblo area, and then here they. So it's, to me, it's a, ironically, you know, the whole sort of recurring refrain in this movie is, I hate the fucking West. But in fact, this movie is Valentine to the West. It is a beautiful homage to this place that is the West. And one of the great things about living in Santa Fe is that, you know, other famous people are occasionally there. And there's a restaurant that we like to go to pretty frequently. And so one night we got to see Wes Studi. He was there dining. And, you know, I like to think that Wes saw me, maybe not, but we're going to go with that. But then the other night that we were there, I've lived in the West my whole life. I've lived in Alaska. I've lived in Washington. I grew up in Arizona. I've never seen a mountain lion. Never. And I can't believe it. I backpack. I river run. I so should have seen a mountain lion. I've never seen a mountain lion. My human equivalent of a mountain lion is Robert Redford. I live in New Mexico sometimes. I live in Utah sometimes. He lives in New Mexico and Utah. I have never seen Robert Redford. Not ever. And I totally should have. So we're sitting in the restaurant one night and having dinner. And I looked up and I said, mountain lion just came into the restaurant. And he came in and he sat down with some people. And I will say I had on an absolutely smashing dress. And so I, in fact, know that the mountain lion saw me too.
Was the mountain lion glowing? I can only imagine that Robert Redford, when he walks into a room, just has an aura about him as he's just like, hi, I'm the most handsome man that ever lived.
Yeah, he is. Most definitely the most handsome man who ever lived. Although, you know, he's really quite short.
Is he now?
Yeah.
Well, he's an actor, right? So it's a thing. Also, you said you grew up in the West. I did not hear Florida in any of those states. I'm just saying. No. And we also have mountain lions in Florida. We call them panthers. So, although here in Colorado, I understand we call them cats for short. Is that a thing that you guys do up in?
Yes.
I guess I can say over and also down because you're in Utah and also New Mexico. So like cats, is that the colloquial term for mountain lions out here?
Yeah, cats. If you're in Texas, they get called panthers sometimes or pumas. You'll hear them called pumas, panthers, cats, mountain lions. Yeah.
So in Florida, actually, I'll do a quick Texas Panther story. You know, in Florida, the Panther population dropped significantly down to, I think, about 30 or so in the 1990s. And there was a movement to bring in Panthers from Texas and kind of rehabilitate the population of Florida. And it worked to a degree. Of course, they're still critically endangered. But when I was working for the tribe down in Florida, I would talk to elders. And this is all information they said I can share, so I'll tell the story. But I remember talking to an elder, said, you know, after they brought those panthers in from Texas, they just got mean. He's like these panthers in Florida just got mean after they started breeding in with them. I don't know what that means. I've never been close enough to a panther to find out if it's polite or has an attitude. I don't care to, but you know, same with grizzly bears, which scared the bejesus out of me. And we'll talk about grizzly bears in a minute. But yeah, so our boy here, Seth MacFarlane, he's a settler. I'm pushing back a little bit now. I think there's obviously been a lot about settler history and things like that. And I'm trying to, in some ways, I don't know that settlers at their time, and maybe you know this better than I can, because I want to talk about the human process of these people who were moving out into the West during the time period. I don't get the sense that they knew they were being caught up in this, actively thinking they were being caught up in this great act of, say, displacing natives and things like that. At least that's not the experience I get. I think we kind of look at it and say, this is clearly what was going on. But I'm kind of wondering, like, we talk about a million ways to die in the West. Everything can fucking kill you. Why would you move to the West? What is pushing and pulling these people out there to begin with?
I think that's an important idea to get at. And for a lot of people, the West is opportunity. It's a chance to start again. It's a chance particularly to reinvent yourself. And the federal government is going to play a really active role in that. I mean, one of the things that happens is that the United States grows in these great big gulps, right? We did Louisiana Purchase in 1803. We do the Oregon Territory in 1846. We do the Mexican Cession in 1848. We do the Gadsden Purchase in 1853. So in just like a really short period of time, basically 50 years, we become a nation that expands from sea to shining sea. And for a federal government that wants to exert sovereignty, settlement is really essential. In fact, that's a term I like to use. Settlement is sovereignty. You need to settle a place with people who are loyal to your government. And so the way the United States is going to facilitate that is by giving away land. And they give away so much land through the Homestead Act, Timber and Stone Act, the Mining Act, all of these acts in the 1860s and 70s, and then are designed to facilitate people coming west and taming and claiming the land. And then we, as if it's not enough, then we say, okay, we'll make it much easier for you to get out there. That whole wagon train thing is a bummer. So let's build railroads. And we complete the first one in 1869. By 1890, there are five transcontinental railroads. So that's an astonishing expansion in a really short period of time, all of which is funded by the federal government. And you get people who come out to the West and say, okay, you know, I've got 160 acres, but there's no water and I can't farm. So we say in 1902, okay, we'll pass the Newlands Reclamation Act and the federal government will bring you water, not force you to settle where there is water. That was John Wesley Powell's idea, but instead we'll bring the water to you. So you want to live where Las Vegas is? You want to live in Los Angeles? You want to live in Phoenix? Which, by the way, no one should live in those places in any sort of numbers. Then
they're deserts.
They're deserts. They're really, yeah, that's, and they sure as heck shouldn't be trying to grow Kentucky bluegrass in their yards in order to make it bloom like a rose and, you know, claim and tame the land. But all of that is really facilitated by a federal government eager to get people to come out west. They make it financially possible for many people to come out west, and they don't put any restrictions on people. So you can come out west and you can shoot all the animals, and we're not going to legislate that. We're not going to say, no, you can't kill every last buffalo. We're not going to do that. So there's a lot of incentive. You get with the Transcontinental Railroad, one of the ways that they incentivized the railroads to build was not only to pay them per mile of track, but also to give them alternating sections of land alongside the roads they were building. Well, the only way to sell those is through advertising. And so these railroads are going to be advertising about how awesome it is in the West. I mean, one of these I've actually memorized because it's so astonishing. And one of these railroad advertisements said, "This is the sole remaining section of paradise in the Western world. All the wild romances of the gorgeous Orient dwindle into nothing when compared to the everyday realities of Dakota." And so how could you not want to go there?
Sarah, it sounds to me like what you're telling me is this idea of the lone man who's making it on his own, the self-made man out in the West is full of shit.
Oh, big shit. Yeah. And the truth is, if you were the lone self-made man, you would have ended up like the Revenant. It's just not going to work for you. So it's in fact the communalism. You know, you see that in the Mormon pioneers who come to Utah, but you also see it on the farming frontier and the mining frontier. People don't mine out in the middle of nowhere. They coalesce in these boom towns. They don't maybe last for very long, but it's not like they're out there all by themselves. And even those fur trappers and traders, they have to get together every once in a while at the rendezvous, because that's how you make money doing this thing that you're out there doing. And no trapper is out on his lone own self trapping beavers or anything like that. Because for one thing, you know, it took a lot of native knowledge to help these fur traders and trappers know where to go, when to trap them, how to trap them, how to skin them, how to dress them out, and how to pack them in order to get them to market in the first place. So there's just that whole mythology of the lone man in the West it makes for a really good Clint Eastwood movie, but not much else.
It makes for a really good Robert Redford movie.
Jeremiah.
That movie is seductive. We've talked about it on the pod. I'm going to do another one on it at some point in time because I want to go back and revisit it. I grew up with Jeremiah Johnson. I've watched it about a million times. I love the film, and it's complete bunk, you know. So
it is. It's complete bunk. And so, you know, I'm sure at some point you want to talk about favorite Western movies. And, you know, I'm a big Robert Redford fan, too. It's my mountain lion, after all. But it's much more fun to talk about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because you got to have both of them working together. That and a nice woman to go have raindrops fall on your head with.
I want to ask you about who's out there in the West, the settlement of the West. Our protagonists, all of our main characters are whites. Who's out in the West? Is it exclusively white settlers? Are there African Americans who are moving West as well? We certainly know that the railroads are being built by a number of people who are different, different ethnicities. Who's in the West themselves? Like, who's out there?
It's kind of, I think, a better thing to say, you know, it's hard to imagine who isn't in the West. It's about numbers, to be sure. But of course, as I talked about in the beginning, when I was talking about the big history of the West that I try to cover in my book, I mean, of course, Native people have been here for 20, 30,000 years. And by the time that anybody else showed up, they are living a diversity of lives, speaking myriad languages, having adapted, some of them agriculture, some of them continuing to hunt and gather, some of them living incredibly rich lives along the Pacific coast. So even trying to lump people into big categories, I find just not very useful or even enlightening. We have to talk about, in some ways, one of the things I like to do in the book is talk about these regions of the West and how people have to adapt to their particular environments. So if you live in, you know, what is today California on the coast, you have such rich sea life that you don't need to embrace agriculture, sedentary agriculture. And you can still have all of the trappings of a sedentary people, even though you aren't engaged in agriculture, which, you know, if you're going to live like the Fremonts or the Papagos in the interior West, where it's much more arid, then you are going to have something that's much more reliable in terms of food. Agriculture provides that. But if you're living in an arid place, then you're going to have to bring in irrigation. And that takes a level of sophistication that belies a simple hunting and gathering kind of existence as well. So we have these myriad different native groups living throughout the West in a variety of strategies that work really well for them over, you know, and that is sustainable over thousands, in some cases, even tens of thousands of years. And Europeans can come in the space of 200 or 300 years, wipe out most of the charismatic megafauna of the West. That's an astonishing shift that is going to happen. And of course, you have Hispanic agriculturalists who have moved up from what is today Mexico into the interior West. You have the mining frontier and the California Gold Rush in particular that brings the world in. So it's an incredibly heterogeneous population that comes to California in just a very few years. Of course, you know, white New Englanders, yes, but free blacks and Hispanics and Mexicans and Asians and Europeans and all kinds of people are converging in the West, and they're going to stay, and they're going to bring the kind of skills with them that leave their mark on the West. I my first job teaching at the college level was at College of Eastern Utah in Price, Utah. And one of the things that had brought people to Price, Carbon County, was coal mining. And in particular, there had been a group of Italian stonemasons. And so there are some spots in and around Price that have this just gorgeous stonework that is that silent testimony. There was also a socialist bookstore that was just about to close when I moved there.
I love like how the intellectual labor comes with people as they move around. And this isn't just particular to say the United States or anything like that. You know, anywhere you go, people moving, changing, so forth. And when they do, like you're saying, showing up in Price and all of a sudden there's this amazing Italian artwork that you wouldn't, or Italian work that you were thinking, this doesn't belong here, right? But it does.
But it does. Yeah, absolutely.
I also have to tell you, you said my two favorite words in the all of history that I like to use in my work, charismatic megafauna. Every time I say it, people are like, what? And can you talk about what I know what it is. I love it because I think I stole it from Dan or maybe Ranella. I don't know where I first heard it. But like, what's charismatic megafauna and like, why do we care about it?
So when the Endangered Species Act was being discussed a lot of support for it. And when you look at the legislation as it was passed, there's almost no votes, because people assumed that what we were going to protect were charismatic megafauna, the sort of iconic animals that, you know, everyone, I'll use my air quotes there, everyone can agree we value and like. So buffalo and bald eagles and snowy egrets, things like that. When we started applying the Endangered Species Act to snail darters and humpback chubs and this slug and some kind of lichen, they were saying, well, no, wait a minute, that's not what we wanted. We just pretty. Wanted the big pretty stuff. Exactly. Right. And so that's what we're talking about, the big pretty stuff. Charismatic megafauna is a fancy way of saying the big pretty stuff. And in truth, you know, sometimes you do have to use the big pretty stuff to get people invested in caring about something bigger than just a single species, but instead talking about the ecosystem. And a classic example of that in the Pacific Northwest is the spotted owl controversy. Mm-hmm. When logging threatened the last of the redwood tree stands there, activists wanted to find something that was endemic to old growth forests. If you can find something that's endemic to old growth forests, then if those forests are logged, that species is going to be pushed into extinction. Well, one of the most symbiotic animals with old growth forest is a red vole, which is neither charismatic nor megafauna. So the environmentalists were like, oh, okay, that's definitely red vole's not it.
How the hell are we going to sell this, right?
Yeah, we can't sell this. But what we can sell is spotted owl. And a spotted owl is cute. We can make stuffed spotted owls. And spotted owls also have a really helpful feature, which is that when you're trying to count them in the forest, if you know how to hoot like a spotted owl, they'll hoot back. So they're really easy to count in that way. But that was a very calculated move. We need an iconic animal, I'll think of it.
Keystone.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, we need a keystone species for the old growth forest so that we can lobby for its protection. And a red vole, so isn't it, but a cute fluffy owl is. And so that's the idea. People can rally around even wolves. People, if you make really cool, you know, stuffed wolves and things like that, people will be more inclined to be supportive of wolves than if you, well, and there are people who are plenty willing to make them vicious, awful animals too.
Yeah. Can we talk about wolves? Because we actually see wolves in this film as well, right? McFarland, there's a scene where the wolves are like, I was literally working on a post on my Substack about the wolf reintroduction. And I was like, oh, son of a bitch. This is actually in the film too, right? Where the wolves are tearing the man apart. They're dragging him off. Right. Dragging the mayor off.
Yeah, he's out there. How bad is the fucking West? That mayor's been over there for 3 days, dead. The leading official in the town, and he's over there, and oh my gosh, there's wolves. Wolves are dragging. And so that's another. So, you know, that's the Liam Neeson thing where, oh, wolves are going to come in and attack people. No, they don't. That's a really funny moment in the
Can
movie.
We talk then about the importance of wolves to ecosystems? I know that. Absolutely. You know, certainly here in Colorado, we're reintroducing wolves. For the longest time, they were really shot down and killed as fast as we possibly could to make room for ranchers. Can you talk a little bit about the history of wolf, maybe eradication, and then the argument for wolf reintroduction into its native lands?
So there was an understanding or belief, I should say, in the government, in society, that wolves are bad. They predate on sheep and cows, and they are a nuisance to our capitalistic acquisition of profit. Ergo, we need to get rid of them. And the federal government, again, just like it was giving away land, was also very willing to get on the side of those trying to live on those lands on their good side by eradicating what they didn't like, which was, in this case, wolves. And wolf eradication led to, no big surprise, all kinds of other problems, including, you know, and one of the really great pieces of Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac is his essay, Thinking Like a Mountain. And he talks about his epiphany about this importance of wolves and an ecosystem. He's collapsing a lot of his life's experience into this very pithy story. But what he says is that when he shot this wolf and saw the fierce green fire dying in her eyes, he came to understand that just as ranchers fear their wolves, just as deer fear wolves, mountains fear deer. And when you eliminate the predators, then it allows for a prey bloom that is devastating to the ecosystem. And he talked about, with the eradication of wolves came these wrinkled hillsides that had been overgrazed by too many deer that no longer had any predators. And the same happened at Grand Canyon, for example. They had a deer eruption following the elimination of predators. And so that there's this tension between wanting these charismatic species like deer and elk and understanding that predators take them out. So Colorado has passed a reintroduction program. The state of Utah, following a decade-long study that was done up in Idaho that showed absolutely no correlation between deer populations and the presence of wolves, the state of Utah nevertheless passed an anti-wolf law, which is called a Mule Deer Protection Act. It's called the Mule Deer Protection Act because we got to save these poor little mule deers from these vicious killers that are wolves. And so it allows Utahns to shoot on-site wolves that are coming into Utah, which is going to create all kinds of problems for the Colorado reintroduction. Because, of course, wolves don't go, oh, crap, that's the boundary to Utah. Can't go there. And we're seeing the expansion of Mexican wolves, particularly in Arizona and New Mexico. There's one wolf in particular who keeps going way outside the study area where she's supposed to be. They keep getting her and moving her back. And a few days later, hundreds of miles from where they've dropped her, there she is again. But those animals, predator species, play a really important role in the stability and overall health of the ecosystem. Because when you go out and hunt, you don't say to yourself, okay, which is the puniest, sickest, lamest looking deer in that herd? That's the one for me. But that's exactly what a wolf or a wolf pack is looking for, or a coyote pack. They're looking for taking out the weak and the sick. It's that, you know, Darwinian evolutionary, we need to protect the best and the brightest for the future. Hunting actually goes after the best and the brightest. And when you can have a combination of both, predators who can cull the weak and the sick, and hunting to help keep populations of prey species in balance, that's the best thing of all. People like to think that nature works in extremes. If we don't have any deer, or excuse me, if we don't have any wolves, we'll have plenty of deer for next hunting season. And that's just way too simple. Nature's more complicated than that.
Yeah, anybody that thinks that like the mule deer need to be protected from wolves needs to take a hard look at like chronic wasting disease and see what happens when deer get infected with that and see the horrible deaths that some of these animals entirely because of an overpopulation of the species, right? And that's when that disease spreads. And again, it spreads because you don't have apex predators taking these animals. And look, you know as well as I did, wolves are not the only apex predator taken out of the Rockies in the West. We talked about cats earlier. Panthers certainly took a beating. There are no grizzly bears. I have a hard time believing there's no grizzly bears anywhere in Colorado. I know that I've seen reports, but grizzly bears as well. I wanted to ask, did you read the Rick McIntyre series, The Wolves of Yellowstone?
Actually, I got to talk to Rick. I got to spend an afternoon watching Wolves with Rick and talking to
him. Are you serious?
Yeah. I hate you.
Yeah, Go on. Oh my gosh, tell me.
It was really great. And I was really proud of him for putting out that series because what's the book that the guy wrote about 06? Nate Blakeslee wrote, and he won all kinds of prizes and he made a lot of money. And a lot of the notes from Nate's book are actually notes from Rick. So it was really good because Rick has not missed a day going out and looking at the wolves in Yellowstone. And so it's a really good thing and he has seen how these packs have evolved over time. And one of the cool things that happened in Yellowstone with the reintroduction was that one of the most immediate consequences was that they went in and eliminated about half of all of the coyotes, just like that, man. They hunted them down.
Oh my gosh. It's brutal in his books. He's talking about the wolves. And listen, if you're listening right now and you don't want to listen about coyote pups getting killed by wolves, it's too late. I mean, it is, and that's exactly what happened, because when you extirpated wolves from Western North America, coyotes spread. I mean, that they clearly moved past that and filled that niche, right?
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that we learned when we went to the coyote research facility, which is just outside of Logan, you know, one of the curiosities is that wolves, gray wolves, and coyotes do not hybridize. They do back east, so you get coy wolves back east, you get red wolves down in the south. But here in the west, gray wolves and coyotes don't hybridize. And in part, it's because they have this long history of clashing with one another. And when we went to the Predator Research Facility, they had actually tried to, you know, artificially inseminate coyotes and wolves with the other. And a lot of them were born, stillborn. A lot of the pups were stillborn. And if they weren't, the mother came in and just killed them instantly. It came out. It's like, oh God, that's not mine. And killed them. So it was a really interesting insight into why those two don't mix.
Yeah. For people who are listening now, who haven't read those books, Rise of Wolf 8 was the first one I read. I've read the first two. The Reign of Wolf 21? I think is this, the way he writes those books is unlike anything I've ever read. He does. It's not like he's anthropomorphizing the animals, but he's writing about them in ways that it's just way. Yeah. It's like, he doesn't give them names like Tommy the Wolf or Sarah, you know, it's like, or anything like that. At the same time, he's talking about like Wolf 21 loved Wolf 42. And when she dies, oh my God, at the end of that book, when she dies, I was in tears when this wolf dies. Yeah. Of course, this wolf died 20 years ago, right? But still, it was like...
Well, but Rick has put in the time to really get to know these wolves as individuals. And, you know, that's a very admirable trait. It also means he's out in some of the most god-awful, miserable weather that is possible.
Yeah, right. But I mean, he's writing like a different kind of history. And that's the thing, you know, when I talk to people about the need, and this is where maybe I want you to, if you'll chime in, talk about this. It's like, I try to talk about the importance of environmental history because so many people get wrapped up, with labor history or, you know, history of peoples. Why is the history of animals, the history of places so important to understanding the human experience?
Well, because we're animals, and I mean that's the shorthand answer to that. We don't like to think of ourselves as another animal, but the truth is, of course, we are. And there's a lot to be learned from the way we interact with animals and what happens when we don't accord other species the same kinds of considerations that we want to have accorded. And again, you know, and I mentioned this before, so I won't go into a big long rant here, but one of the things we see is this human desire to separate ourselves from other animals has led us to wanting to put commodity values on them. And we don't tend to value them as live animals. That's to me the most shocking thing. What we value is not, for a long time at least, what we valued was not wolves. What we valued was dead wolves. What we valued was not buffalo. We valued dead buffalo and dead elk and, you know, the rack that I get to put or the stuffed head that I get to mount. That's valuable. But somehow the animal that has that, it isn't valuable. And, you know, there's this wonderful quote from Byron of Busy Sheath or whatever. And he says, you know, men may hunt animals for sport, but animals do not die in sport. Animals die in pain.
I'm having steak tomorrow. I just want you to know that.
Oh, well, and it'll be tasty, I bet.
Always going to be. It's the way I make it. Yeah. Absolutely. I have a question for you, actually. So we're talking about the idea of there's a place of the West. We're talking about these ideas of the West. Have you, in your experience, have you done comparative work? Or does our version of the West happen in other places? Is this a uniquely American story? Or where's the West beyond the United States? Do you have any experience like looking at other places like that too, or no?
You know, I haven't done a lot of comparative history, but of course, every place has what Patty Limerick calls the F word. Every place has had its own frontier experiences. Where and if what we're thinking about the West being this place where people and nature come together in a variety of patterns and fashions over a long period of time, then of course that happens everywhere else in the world. It may not be the West, and you know, the unique realities of aridity and public lands in our West create the unique situation that is our particular history in this particular place. And I really do think that place matters a great deal. It's one of my big frustrations with the Buffalo Bill Wild West Congress of Rough Riders and all that, because he never called it a show. And one of the things that's most striking to me about that is that it tried to encapsulate all of these icons of the West, buffalo and wagon trains and Buffalo Bill being every kind of hunter and scout and all of that. But it's placeless. He did the shows in Chicago. He did them in New York. He did them in London for the Queen. They did it in Paris. And it's like, yeah, but you don't get any of these things or these experiences if you aren't also in the place. I mean, in one of the seasons of the show, I forget if it was when they were in New York or whatever, but they lost like half of their buffalo because the buffalo are just like, yeah, I don't want to live in New York. And so they turned up their toes and said, see ya. And so, I mean, place really, really matters a lot. There are some patterns to talking about the place that is our West that I think we can look at in other places. But I would also argue that on the planet, it is a completely unique place. And as a result, its history is in some ways typical, but also in many ways very unique.
What do you think a guy like McFarlane can do with a comedy about the West, telling his stories about the West that like we don't see in like your classic John Ford-esque Westerns are almost really serious films, right? Even mm-hmm. the fun ones to watch, like Tombstone, right? They're very serious films. This mm-hmm. one is not. This and like you're saying, Blazing Saddles, and I can't really think of many other Westerns that are jokey.
Silverado. Silverado's close.
We just did that too on HATO. Yeah. God, I love
I mean,
that
if nothing else, yeah, me too. And watching Kevin Costner.
Kevin Kline. Kevin Costner's a baby in that movie.
He is, yeah. But Kevin Kline is just
he's so good.
Wickedly
he's so good
in that. Yeah, he really is.
Can I tell you a thing I thought about Costner recently? We're watching him in Silverado, and I'm thinking about Costner's career. Obviously, he's all over the place with Yellowstone, which I could ask you a billion questions on as well. We're going to be doing a pod on 1883 at some point in time. But I look at Costner's career. I'm thinking about this, about Silverado. I'm thinking about, you know, he did Wyatt Earp. He did obviously Dances. He's doing Yellowstone. At some point, don't we have to start to consider him in the pantheon of classic Western stars? I mean, look at if the body, he doesn't feel like, you know, he doesn't feel like John Wayne or Clint Eastwood, but the body of work has got to be there, right? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm way more comfortable putting him in the pantheon of ball sports films.
Oh, definitely. It's, you know, number one in baseball.
That guy's an athlete. Yeah, that guy's an athlete. You can tell he knows how to swing a bat and he knows how to throw a ball. He can hit a golf club, but he can also ride a horse. I mean, in Silverado, he does some amazing horse work. So, I don't know if I want to put him in.
Is Silverado that Kevin Kline's film? I mean, you got four leads there. Is it Kline's film or is it Scott Glenn's film?
Oh, no, it's definitely, I would say, yeah, it's definitely Kevin's film, Kline.
Yeah, he's the one with the character arc, I think.
You know? He is. But, you know, every once in a while, they're just really funny in that movie.
Oh, they're great. The movie, I mean, there are just real, real moments of that. I'm kind of wondering, thinking about the West, are there films that you love that really get at the history of the West?
Well, so as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Right.
In part because the eye candy is just too irresistible. And it's a great story too. And I know you're a big fan of Hell or High Water.
I think it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and I love Chris Pine, you know, he can be in any movie and I'm really happy.
Can we talk about that for a second? Because sure. That was the movie that I thought Chris Pine was too pretty to be serious, you know? Mm-hmm. And that final scene with him and Jeff Bridges on the porch.
Uh-huh.
As Bridges is sitting there drinking and Pine's got the rifle just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
That is an awesome, talk about tense scene between two actors.
Well, and they did such a good job conveying, you know, without a doubt that he'll plug him. Mm-hmm. He will totally shoot him. And Jeff Bridges' character knows that too. And the scene is so brilliantly filmed, you know, that tension just comes. And then you discover he doesn't actually own the place. He's given it to his kids. Yeah.
And you get the sense that Pine's kind of wanting to die. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, hey, maybe I'll come see you about that thing. And they're like, okay, mm-hmm. This only unresolved.
Bring it.
And the brilliance of that film that it talks so much about the history of the West. There's the scenes in the casino. Where Pine's brother's talking to the Comanche gentleman about the West and all this kind of, I mean, they're talking so much. God, I love the movie, but go on. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to be unconventional in my choice of Westerns, like
all right.
Really unconventional. And we're going to talk about Avatar. Avatar
okay.
is a Western.
Go on.
It has all of the tropes of the Western. It is a native group that is invaded by extractive entrepreneurs who don't care about the land itself, who have no connection to place. And it's about dispossession. It's about the market and the value placed on nature that creates unobtainium. And yet, in the end, the Indians win. I mean, that never happens in any Western ever. So, you know, I would argue that makes it a really awesome Western.
Do you have a least favorite Western? Do you have one that just makes you pull your hair out when you watch it or when you think about it?
Yeah, but I'm going to get in trouble. I just don't. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is just kind of it's a dumbass film, you know, bless their hearts. And I know I'm supposed to like it, but I just don't. And part of it is watching a lot of those, The Quiet Man. And I know I'm speaking about John Wayne here, but as a woman, I don't find any resonance, you know, where I'm supposed to just shut up be in the film as a woman. A lot of those old movies just really don't sit very well with me.
Do you think John Wayne hurts the West? I mean, what's John Wayne's effect on the West?
I think John Wayne is, for the West, what zoo animals are for protection. I think it gets some people to care about something that otherwise they might not. And so when you see a tiger in the zoo, you think, oh, I love tigers. And you see John Wayne in a movie and you think, oh, I love the West because John Wayne loves the West. So how's that for an analogy that maybe you weren't expecting?
I'm wondering, how did you come to the West itself, though? Is it just because you grew up in Arizona and all this kind of stuff? Or like, where is your affection for I mean, you could have been a scholar of anything. Why the West?
You know, I am such a Western girl. I grew up in the Phoenix area, and I saw what Phoenix was and has become. I grew up in an era when Bruce Babbitt was the governor, when Stuart Udall and Mo Udall were affecting the West in real and important ways. I did a stint in graduate school at Washington State. Then I taught in Price. I spent a summer working in the Tetons. I spent a summer working in Denali in Alaska. I went back to Washington State. And when I was teaching at Price at College of Eastern Utah, I was the entire history department. And I got to teach an environmental studies class that was part classroom experience. We'd read stuff, and then part field experience. We took students out backpacking, river running, hiking all over southern Utah. And I really came to have a powerful affiliation for another part of the West that I came to know really pretty intimately. And so when it was time to go back and get my PhD, I was talking with my major advisor and I said, you know, I don't know what to do for a topic. And he said, well, you know, my friend Rod Grammer and I just wrote this huge biography on Frank Church, senator from Idaho, but we didn't really talk about his environmental politics. And I said, is there material? And he said, Sarah, there's a ton. And we just, you know, that's not our area of interest. And I said, but it's mine. And he said, yeah, I know. I think this could be your project. And so because he had the insight into Frank Church and I had this interest in trying to figure out how do I put my love of history and my love of nature and the outdoors and the West in particular, how do I put all that together? And this became the solution to that problem. And I will say, you know, I avoided history for a long time. My undergraduate degree is in public relations and journalism. My master's degree is in American studies because I kept thinking, I can't do history. But then I got a job teaching history at College of Eastern Utah doing this environment. And I thought, okay, this is actually it. This is actually it. And researching Frank Church and his involvement in wilderness and wild and scenic rivers and Land and Water Conservation Fund, to me, that just really kind of cemented it.
Okay, this explains so much to me about your book now, because I have to tell you, as I was reading it, I kept reading, because, you know, this is before you and I kind of got to know each other. So I was reading this book, and we had talked a couple of times. And it was really the first time I'd kind of read your stuff. And I'm reading it going, God damn, she can write. And that was, there's so many really brilliant people that I know that can't. And this is good shit. You know, that's the highest honor. This is good shit. Was the thing when I was reading your stuff. So if you're listening and you're looking, this is not the hard, chewy book to read. And I think for the longest time in the profession, like, good writing was almost seen as like this negative aspect of like what it is that we do. It's almost like, well, the writing's too good, it can't be good scholarship. And that's fucking bullshit. I love the way you write. So
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
Oh, you could have
thought. That's really important because I did not write this book to be a textbook. I wrote this book to be a trade book, to be the sort of thing that people who just love the West, who aren't looking for a million ways to die in it, are, you know, I'm curious I want to know more. That's the kind of target audience. And then, of course, if you do know some things about the West or the environment or whatever, my hope is that you'll say, oh, now I see how that connects to all these other things. And I think the best compliment I've gotten other than the one you just gave is, you know, I've had people say, I knew some of this stuff, but I had no idea how it all kind of fit together. And to me, that was the really compelling thing that I wanted to be able to do.
I wonder if you can talk, we've kind of referenced a few things, and you and I have kind of offhanded, kind of referred a few scholars, but who are your influences or who are you reading? For people who are like, hey, I want to know about this environmental history of the West, what's out there that's good that people should read? Like, what do you like?
Well, you know, there's this book called Losing Eden, because it's really, you know, there's just not a lot of environmental history of the West out there. I will say that. I got fired up about environmental history when I was in graduate school by reading William Cronin's Changes in the Land. To me,
I was going to change the joke earlier, but go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it Changes in the Land rearranged the furniture in my head. And it also made me say, oh, this is the kind of history I want to do. This is it. And, you know, I really enjoy still turning people on to his Trouble with Wilderness essay, because I think it makes people think really deeply about the places they love, why they love them, and why they can't love the places that they live most of the time as much as the places that are way out there and far away. So, you know, that for sure, Bill Cronin stuff. I'm obviously a little partial to Dan Flory's work too, but I always try to find a reason to assign Wallace Stegner when I teach, particularly his collection of essay called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs. It's just a really nice collection of Stegner. And anytime I sit down to write, I often find that I write a lot better if I read a little Stegner first. He just makes me up my game in a way that I think makes me a better writer. Absolutely. Reading good writers. You know, we just lost John Nichols, who did the Milagro Beanfield War and the whole Magic Journey series, which was, you know, that's really great writing. I wish I could read Cormac McCarthy more, but he is just so dark that that man had a real gift of language and expression, but my goodness, he just thinks so horribly of our species that it's hard for me.
And my book club is reading The Road right now.
Oh man. So you know, and it is hard. It's hard. And
it's,
you know,
four guys who have kids, and we're reading this book, and we're just like, we're texting, and now you're like, this is depressing as fuck.
Yeah. You gotta be careful about that kind of thing. And then I would say one book that I've really enjoyed over the last couple of years, and I got a chance to work with her on the Ken Burns Buffalo documentary, is Rosalind Lapierre's Invisible Reality.
I don't know this.
Storytellers, Storytakers, and the Supernatural World of the Blackfeet. It's just outstanding. Roz is a PhD out of University of Montana, but she's also a Blackfeet keeper of especially plant knowledge of the Blackfeet. And so she is an herbalist and does a lot with medicine. And this book is just this incredible integration of traditional, really good academic, go to the archive scholarship, and Blackfeet, oral history, traditional interaction with the land. And it's brilliant. And she's brilliant.
I need to get this book like immediately. Yes, you do. I mean, I'm writing my book, which I'll talk to you about. Like, I'm going to beg to talk to you about this in a second after we get off the thing.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the idea of the West and what's at stake here. When we look at 2023, this film is set, you know, I think people tend to think about the West as we see it in film as this thing that happens in 1800. Your book very clearly clearly shows the West is still very, very real, and we are living with it, and there are very real consequences. What are the issues that we are confronting when we look at an environmental history of the West in 2023? It's about to be 2024.
You know, there's just two words, climate change. And one of the things that I find really compelling about the West, and I visit this in the last chapter, is that the West is in many ways the role model for how we deal with changing climate. Because when climate change hits an arid place like the West, and all of the consequences that go with that, the at what cost question again, we're seeing weather extremes, we're seeing water extremes, we're seeing vegetation, human, animal populations, everything being dramatically affected in really short periods of time. How are we going to address those issues? And while at the same time that the West is really at the vanguard of the consequences of environmental change and climate change, it's also at the vanguard of innovation to try to deal with that. When we have these COP conferences, the model is often California for how do we deal with water issues? How do we deal with land issues? How do we deal with renewable energy? What are the challenges that we're facing and how can we very realistically address them? And I will say, I think the most important thing that people can do in 2024 is vote. They're going to have to vote for candidates and initiatives that they believe are in the best interest, not of a small group or moneymakers, but in the interests of society, of nature, and of the earth. I mean, that sounds a little groovy to say, but I truly mean it. I think that, you know, people often say, well, what's the most impactful thing one can do with climate? And, you know, they'll say, okay, well, it's drive a fuel efficient car, or actually don't drive if you can. But, you know, by God, in 2024, I think the most important thing people can do is vote.
I don't even know where to go after that, because that's just fucking perfect. I guess maybe let's circle back to this movie, since this is technically a movie podcast, but whatever. A Million Ways to Die in the West. Is this a history movie?
Absolutely. Because in many ways, Seth is hitting on these Western icons, but also then sort of wiping them out really quickly. Like the scene when Charlize shows up with that metal bustle. And like the best fashion statement a woman can make in 1882 in Arizona is having a fat ass. I mean, that's just, and then they lift up her skirt and there's this thing and he's like, boy, you're really going to cut it loose tonight. And, you know, that's funny, but it's also accurate. And he says, I'm just glad I remembered all six devices that it takes to hold up my pants. And that's accurate. And when they're at the fair and the guy is selling elixirs, you know, and Seth is looking at the bottle and he's like, so cocaine, alcohol, morphine, mercury with chalk, the hell is that? And of course, it's exactly that. And, you know, it's even Ogden stomach bitters, which, you know, I'm in Ogden right now, but there was a Hostetter's stomach bitters that was exactly like that. And that's why we had to have the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act. I mean, and I know that I did buy the DVD and it has some outtakes in it. Oh my God, they're so funny. But they also talk about the costumer was really careful to be accurate with fabrics, with cuts, with all the layers. And, you know, there's a little featurette in here called A Fistful of Dirt in Your Mouth. And it's all about them. And it's all about them filming in New Mexico in these just ferocious dust storms. And then it's hot and then it's hailing. And Charlize Theron says at one point, you know, they're out in Monument Valley. And she's like, yeah, it's great. It's really hot. And of course, I got six petticoats on because somehow somebody decided, some asshole decided that that's beautiful. But, you know, it is beautiful, but God, it's hot. you know. So to me, they did a lot of really good, historically accurate things. And then, you know, just some really fun things. Like, I don't know, you know, I know this because, like, when they do the shots of the fair and they have the Cerritos Hills in the background, they also have, I mean, in scene after scene, they have a cardboard cutout of the mittens. And they just put that thing up everywhere in the background. And there's the mittens, which that's in Monument Valley. That's nowhere near there. But everybody knows, oh, the mittens, that's the West. So that's how you know it's the West. And then you got the guy from Back to the Future, and you got Bill Maher. And one of my favorites, I mean, you know that Seth is a huge Star Trek fan. And in that scene where he's having his vision and the vulture with the big red balls comes, before that, you know, there are the sheep on the super long stilt legs.
Oh, yeah.
And the voice says, "We are the guardians of the future." And of course, it's Patrick Stewart who says that. And I did think at the time, man, if you did an Easter egg drinking game, you would be so obliterated halfway through this movie that maybe, you know, other movie bingo would be a little healthier alternative.
I think you made a pretty good case that this film should be in film studies and the history of the West courses, maybe at Weber State University.
Good job, Ben.
Oh, listen, I had to have Leah tell me like a couple of years ago. She's like, it's Weber State. I was like, oh. Hey, Sarah, where can people find you beyond the realms of this podcast and the classroom at Weber State? Where can people find you online and elsewhere?
So you can obviously order my book. And I do want to say, if you order my book, which is at University of Nebraska Press, and you enter in the code 6HLW23, you get 50% off, which, you know, hooray. It makes, you know, need stocking stuffers? There's your choice. But I'm at Weber State. I'm the chair of the history department. So all you have to do is Google Weber State History, and you'll find me. And I've got an email there. If people want to find me there, I'm on Twitter, but I may not be for much longer.
Have you made the move to Blue Sky yet?
You know, I'm old enough that I'm just not much of the whole social media thing.
You should be done.
So, yeah, just email me.
Good enough. Hey, Sarah, thank you so much for being here tonight. I was so excited to talk to you. I've just been sitting here for the last hour and a half, just been happy. So thank you so much for being here tonight.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate it hugely.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of Movies podcast. Thank you so much to our guest, Sarah Dance. Sarah, you are amazing. I just have the best time talking to you, and I can't wait for you to come back. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Fletcher Powell, who is worth $1 million. Not a million is probably overrated, but he's worth some dollars, like, well, some money. Guys, thank you all for being here. Thank you for continuing to show your support, your enthusiasm for everything we've done, not only just with the podcast, but this Historians of Movies thing that we've been building over the last 5.5 years. You guys are amazing. You keep me going. You keep this show going. This thing ultimately is about you guys. So thank you so much for being here, sharing this out with everybody that you know, and continuing to spread the word about what we're doing here with HATM, the podcast, and the community at large. So thank you so much for being here. Guys, this is a blast. I love this conversation. I hope you're enjoying it too. If you like other movies, you want other scholars on here, let me know. We'll get them up here. But between now and then, we'll see you a little bit later. Ciao for now.